And good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to another fascinating episode. Tonight is February 26, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, my friend. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I don't want to do too much chit-chat because we need to cover a lot of territory tonight.
Well,
but it sure is cold here. It's really getting cold. But I've made a pot of soup broth, so I'm going to be putting the vegetables in tomorrow and everything. So I'm all ready for a nice cold day at home tomorrow. Well, anyway, I want to announce that in my preparation for this evening, I found out that Hitler's Table Talk has been removed from archive.org, and it says because of content. And and that's where I've been. I had it all taken from there already, but it's also on at a PDF. But PDFs are more difficult to copy from. But a PDF by good old VHO.org has it as a PDF. But I haven't investigated this very far. But that's what it was saying. And now isn't that something terrible? What kind of censorship are we experiencing here? Pretty bad.
Yep. The thought control police are vigilant.
Yeah, well, we'll have to look. I'll look into that more, and you can too, of course, but I don't want to talk about it anymore now. I want to get right into our reading. So say that I have a timeline for August 7th, and it is Operation Watchtower begins the Guadalcanal campaign as American forces invade Gavutu, Guadalcanal, Tulagi and Tanambogo in the Solomon Islands. Stuff going on in the Pacific there. I don't know anything about any of it, but anyway, they don't talk about it, so it's just part of what's going on that day.
Yeah. Okay, 7th of August, 1942, evening. Reclamation of the Pontine Marshes. The gentle art of negotiation. The Pontine Marshes can now be put under cultivation thanks solely to quinine. All previous attempts to drain them had been defeated by malaria, and malaria has now in its turn been defeated by quinine. The work itself has been simple. All that was required was the construction of canals leading to the sea. It's the same scheme that Julius Caesar outlined and that many popes later tried to put into practice. The cities in the marshy area have been built on sober colonial lines, but are of excellent quality. Once the war is over, the Duce will be able over a period of 10 or 15 years to build up an immense colonial activity in these regions. The Russian colossus is being destroyed by his own mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the colossus.
The
British Empire is dying because of the small size of its motherland. Moreover, the British have stubbornly adhered to a fixed policy in spite of a complete revolution in conditions. If Churchill goes to see Stalin, the latter will tear the hide off of him. He'll say to Churchill, "I've lost 10 million men thanks to your Mr. Cripps. If he had kept his mouth shut, the Germans would never have attacked." To allow negotiations to be conducted by a man endowed with plenipotentiary powers to take decisions is always a grave mistake, for it enormously enhances the difficulties of repudiation if such should become desirable. It is a mistake I never make. I always send a representative with precise instructions to stop as soon as difficulties arise and to come back and consult me. The Duce follows this same principle. I was just going to say, Carolyn, I really thought it was interesting. I looked up, as you probably did too, this Pontine Marshes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's located in central Italy. It was a huge swampland, a marshland that malaria was always there. It was drained, one of the Duce's primary accomplishments, and became home to an awful lot of people. And then it became controversial in 1943, a year following this, when Germany flooded it to slow down the Allied advance. And of course, it said it reintroduced malaria back into the area. And there was the comment also about, although it was quite an accomplishment, it did destroy, in today's terms, the marshes, you know, and some critical wildlife habitat and marshes. But that was quite an accomplishment for Mussolini to drain that entire area like he did and make it habitable, build on
it. Wow, and then his friend Hitler comes along and undoes everything he did, huh? What could they when the Germans filled it up again? Did they could they have drained it out real easily? I mean, was it not exactly the same as it had been originally?
Yeah, it was certainly the Germans didn't just totally ruin it. I mean, when they flooded it, like I say, it was a military necessity to slow down the Allied advance up from southern Italy and to allow his soldiers to go further north into Italy, you know, and get away from the Allies for a breather. And so that was a military necessity. And yes, you know, because of the flooding, then the malaria came back. But it was... Once it had been shown, you know, how it was done, then it was certainly repairable again.
Yeah. So what is it? What is the status of it today? Is it agricultural land?
You know,
marshes?
Yes, to an extent, and I'm not sure, but I do know that that area was reclaimed, and you know, because it had homes on it and everything too, and so it was reclaimed and. Probably much easier to reclaim it than it was to originally drain it.
Well, that's really interesting.
Useful.
I bet a lot of people don't know anything about that. I never heard of it, but I did look it up. But I didn't read as far as you did. I only read enough to know what they had done originally. Well, that's very good to know. Well, the other about this Mr. Cripps, you know, that's the man that we've talked about him before, and I've written about him in the past, and of course, that's who Churchill sent to. Well, I don't know if Churchill sent. Nobody knows why Cripps went to see Molotov in Moscow and was trying to work out some negotiations, but somebody sent him. Then he was trying to get this agreement, but at that time, Stalin turned him down and chose to make that treaty with Hitler that was made before the invasion of Poland. So, but now this thing with Churchill going to see Stalin is a big thing, but it'll come up in a little while.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I took from this too, were the, on this Cripps, I think that Cripps was one who. Let the cat out of the bag about the Soviet buildup. And, you know, the Germans had picked that out, too. Their own intelligence had seen that Stalin was starting to line up on the Polish frontier with his forces. And I think that Cripps must have said it diplomatically, I mean, in diplomatic terms to
said
somebody,
something.
And the Germans picked it up.
Yeah, because that's what Hitler's saying. He's saying that that Cripps let the cat out of the bag. Well, you used those words.
Exactly right.
He said
that
Cripps didn't keep his mouth shut, and then the Germans. Then maybe the Germans would never have attacked him if he had. So, but I don't know what all the details. I don't think anybody knows for sure what went on there. Maybe Hitler did, but I mean, I don't think today anybody knows.
Right.
Well, okay. A timeline for the 8th. 6 of 8 German would-be saboteurs involved in Operation Pastorius are executed in Washington, D.C. And this was the mission headed by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, chief of the German Abwehr. He had recalled that during World War I, he organized the sabotage of French installations in Morocco and entered the United States with other German agents to plant bombs in New York. arms factories, including the destruction of munitions supplies at Black Tom Island. This was in 1916. I guess that was pretty successful. So he hoped that this new, for World War, now the next war, he hoped that Operation Pastorius, of these saboteurs that Germans that were sent in secretly, you know, would to do some sabotage would have the same success. Well, it didn't, and six of them were executed. I think the other two were imprisoned or something like that. I just think they got them all. And then the naval battle of Savo Island near Guadalcanal took place, and the Americans lost three cruisers. The Australians lost one on the 8th.
Okay. 8th of August, 1942, evening. Special guest, Reichsarbeitsfuhrer Herrl, that's H-I-E-R-L, Herrl. The Goths in the Crimea, bringing order in the East, the gold myth.
It's the Reich Labor Ministry that he is a leader in. He's not the head of it, but he's maybe right underneath. Well, he's a big guy in there.
Okay.
So he's visiting.
It is the Goths who have succeeded in maintaining themselves longest in the Crimea. As recently as the 18th century, there was once a court case in which the litigants could only speak Gothic. No power on earth will eject us. Some of our army groups there have already organized themselves into complete self-supporting entities in every way. The struggle we are waging there against the partisans resembles very much the struggle in North America against the Red Indians. Victory will go to the strong, and strength is on our side. At all costs, we will establish law and order there. I am of the opinion that the use of the present currency in this district should be discontinued in the near future and be replaced by a new currency. This autumn, we must organize markets, rather on the lines of big German fairs, in the vicinity of railway junctions, and beside them we must construct silos for the reception of grain. In these markets, we must display this for sale all the trivialities which our commerce and industry produce. Saxony, for example, will enjoy an unprecedented trade boom, and we shall create for her a most profitable export market, which it will be the task of Saxon inventive genius to develop. In former times, it was Saxony which supplied the colonies with glass beads, trinkets, and other baubles, while Thuringia provided the toys, and both made a notable contribution to our trade balance. In the Bulgarians, we have an ally on whom we can rely against the Turks. The Finns have but one desire, to keep East Karelia and to see St. Petersburg disappear from the face of the earth. Whoever occupies St. Petersburg controls the Baltic. The presence of a second great power in the Baltic would be intolerable for us, too, for it would enable it to swamp the whole sea with mines. In this case, we must revert to the practice of ancient days, and St. Petersburg must be razed to the ground. I was furious when the Air Force were reluctant to attack the place from their bases in Kiev. One day it has got to be done, otherwise the Russians will return and try to set up a government there. We shall soon win the peasantry completely to our side. Already they begin to breathe freely, and for the first time someone has paid them something for their wares. For the most part, these peasants are first-class stock. The remnants of the old Goths are there, for though a language may disappear, the blood remains. The Americans are still delighted so long as they can amass more gold. They do not seem to realize that the stuff has no intrinsic value at all. You may say what you like about our pub strategists, but in comparison with the British speakers on military affairs, they are veritable von Moltkes. They have quite convinced me on one point. You cannot exist in the colonies without Scotch whiskey.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot that's very substantial in here, and I'd like to comment on some of it. Let's see. Now, the Goths, they keep talking about the Goths in Ukraine and now in Crimea. The Gothic, the blood of the Goths, you know, is still there. They can see it in these people. The Germans are saying that because these were Germanic people. So they're right. looking for signs, and they think they find signs of lots of Germanism there, and they think they can get along real well with these people. And, you know, he says, we're there. He loves Crimea just, you know, for good reasons. He says, we're not going to leave. You know, nothing will get us out of there. Unfortunately, didn't go that way, but he likes to think about what they're going to be doing there. He likes that area. And so he's talking about it. But it's interesting. He says the struggle we're waging there against the partisans resembles the struggle of the Americans and the Indians, the Red Indians.
That's right. What I was going to say was, as you know, what he's talking about there is the type of warfare they're waging, which is guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. And rather than conventional fighting with troops and battle formations and things like this, these partisans are doing like the Indians did against our army. And, you know, they would hit
lawless.
And run.
Yeah, lawless,
would,
that's what he said.
Yeah, with ambush. There were no rules of conduct at all. And so that's why he drew the line, the comparison between those two.
Right, it was a real problem. And he says at all costs we'll establish law and order there. So that's how he sees what they're doing. And then he talks about how they'll bring all these things for the consumer goods and so on for the native people to purchase, and thinks that their lives are going to be a lot better. He says we're winning the peasantry to our side, and he says already they begin to breathe freely. For the first time, someone has paid them something for their wares. And there, says their first-class stock, you know, and all of that. So this goes completely against the idea that they seem to be chatting about in other times, you know, how they're going to treat these people. You know, in these conversations, you can really get take the wrong impression from just the common conversation, depending, I suppose, on what kind of things are happening and what threats they're feeling at the time. But we've commented before, and you've commented, Ray, that life was going to be much better for these people under the Germans. There's no doubt about that. And then he brings up St. Petersburg again, and I think this is important. I liked it. He said, we must revert to the practice of ancient days. It wasn't that they were going to go around raising everything, but he thought St. Petersburg really had to be demolished. And you know, when you think about why it was even built there, it's built right on the edge of the Baltic Sea, or maybe it's a bay or something there, and right close in order to, well, kind of like the way Putin is acting today, like showing that they're right there next to these other countries, and they wanted control of Finland. They had control of Finland, and they wanted control of the of Estonia and Latvia and even Lithuania, and they were right there with them. And so it was very bad for these countries to have this major city there, which was the second largest in Russia and had been Leningrad. But it's not just, you know, you have to look at the situation and why they had why they wanted to do that. It's not just that they were going to do that everywhere. That
right.
Some people were saying, like Franklin Reichardt, who was complaining about that at my website in the comments. He always does. He always says the same old thing. How the Germans wanted to kill all the Slavic people and Russians and destroy everything and move in there and, you know, push them out and so on. So that's what he likes to say.
Mm-hmm. You know, you alluded to this earlier, as we have done this study, it seems to me that I have noticed that Hitler covers such varied subjects and such fascinating comments about different things going on and whatever, but there haven't been that many comments about the war itself, about the fighting, particular battles or anything like this. And so when he does say something, it jumps at me. And that one sentence there, he says, you know, about the Crimea, no power on earth will eject us. Some of our army groups there have already organized themselves into complete self-supporting entities in every way. And this just tells you, this is a tip-off, that at that particular time in August of 1942, the Germans still hold the upper hand very well, and their military successes are still going on. And that just, you know, it was good to see. And when that's the case, I think that's when he really, you know, he doesn't want to spend time talking about anything about the fighting and whatever. He throws all this other stuff in there that's just fascinating.
You're right, right. I think so, too. No, he's not going to discuss the fighting with these people at dinner time, you know, I mean, in these
right.
in these groups, because there's a lot of people there. Secretaries are always there and so on, and he doesn't go into that, but he did say a little bit more this time. Okay, well, I don't
right.
have any more timelines for a while.
Okay, we'll go to August 9th, 1942, midday. Special guests are Reich Ministers von Ribbentrop and Dr. Lammers, Reichsführer SS Himmler, Gauleiters Berkel, Simon, Robert Wagner.
Well, since this was such a big group of people, Ray, I looked them all up to be sure who they all were, and I thought the listeners might want to know that
yes.
Lammers, there's two Reich ministers. Von Ribbentrop, everybody knows who he is, foreign minister, but Dr. Lammers is the, as we've talked about him before, but I forgot what he was, and he's the head of the chancellery. You know, he runs the chancellor's
the
office, so to speak. Yeah,
and yeah.
He's a former jurist, but he was a very good jurist, and Hitler had thought very highly of him.
Right.
And the Gauleiters, oh, and then Himmler was there. Himmler's there, and the Gauleiters.
Yeah.
Berkel is the Gauleiter of Vienna. Simon is the Gauleiter of what they call Moselland, but Mosel is a wine. And that's where they grow the wine. It's actually in Rhineland-Pfalz, the state of Rhineland-Pfalz. And Robert Wagner is the Gauleiter of Baden, and that's the one that is close to the Alsace-Lorraine. And he was a real strong National Socialist, did a very good job, but, of course, therefore the enemy hates him, and they tried him as a war criminal after the war for saying he committed all these crimes against the French. Just think about all the crimes the French committed against the Germans that nobody cares about. But anything that the Germans did to the French, oh, well, wow. But, you know, he wasn't executed, and he was released like so many others, like in 1954 or something like that.
Yeah.
But
right.
that's who's there. Hitler, you know, is very likes his Gauleiters because he thinks they almost all do a very good job.
Right. Our topics are Britons have no right in Europe. Yeah, Britons have no rights in Europe.
Uh-huh.
R-I-G-H-T-S, no rights in Europe. The Great German Reich, the granary of the East. The British are nothing but a twig from the German tree. They have no claim whatever to a share in the responsibility for the security of Europe. For that, Germany is prepared to accept full and sole responsibility. By harsh rule, we must bring law and order to the continent. The Balkans, we will leave alone for the moment so that we can continue to export arms to them. If the Hungarians go to war with the Romanians, then unless I am much mistaken, Antonescu will knock hell out of them. The day will come when the Viennese idea will be proved to be right. In the 10,000 cafes of Vienna, this is how the Hungarian problem is envisaged. Hungary belongs to us, and the people in Berlin know nothing about it. It was we who liberated the Hungarians from the Turks, and order will not be restored in Hungary until we liberate the country again. So why on earth don't we take it over and have done with it? And the Slovenes, it's no doubt fine that they should be independent, but after all, they too belong to us. Vienna is becoming more pan-Germanic than the Germans themselves. They are inspired by the feeling that they have a mission to fulfill, and we might just as well egg them on a little. Belgrade used to be a miserable little collection of hovels. It was Prince Eugen who brought fame to the city. From the east, we shall get between 10 and 12 million tons of grain annually. I think we ought to build spaghetti factories on the spot. All the prerequisites are there. This will enable us to give a little extra to those western territories which are rich in industry but badly off as regards foodstuffs. There's one thing about which we must be quite clear. Anyone here who gets ideas above his station and beyond the confines of his farm must be sharply jumped on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, you know, short, but a very, very packed.
Right.
You know, the British have no rights in Europe, you know, and actually they're interlopers and meddlers.
He's finally come to that conclusion. Before, you know, he wanted to work with the British, and he kept wanting to work with the British, but now he knows that that's not going to happen. So now he's kind of putting him down, saying they're just Germans who have gone off to that island. And they don't deserve to rule over anything in Europe. Because I think this is just my thought, that what he has in mind is like Belgium and Netherlands and those countries along the coast there that are so close to England, and they feel connected with England and more than Germany. And he wants to bring he wants those countries to be a part of his European United group, and he wants to cut these people off from Britain. So I think that's kind of what's in his mind. He's probably a little bit irritated that these peoples, because they're a lot of them are Germanic people, and they stay, particularly the Dutch, and then the Norwegians too, and they want to stay kind of loyal and connected with Britain more than to Germany. So he's got that to deal with.
Right, and he's so pleased with Austria, all of a sudden, which he states here is actually more nationalistic than Germany itself, you know, that they've really gotten in on this pan-Germanic idea.
Well, they were. And they were the most patriotic Germans, people, you know, then they always were, though. But he's talking about Vienna. And Vienna as a city was always kind of international and, you know, all that kind of thing, and also full of Jews. Well, they did clean out Vienna. I don't know if it was cleaned out yet, but they are working on it. And so he sees better things going on in Vienna now, I guess. You even pronounced Prince Eugen's name right.
Good.
Didn't you? Well, you said instead of Eugene, you said Eugen.
Yeah,
and
that's, I said Eugen.
That's what it is. In German, you probably know who he is.
One of the major ships was named after him, and that's
right.
That's the first I heard of his name, and that's why I knew it was pronounced Eugen.
Yeah, well, he was a great military leader, and there was a Prince Eugen division during World War II that was former Austria, and was very valiant. And then this Hungary and Romania thing, it goes on, that he says he thinks the Romanians would beat the Hungarians if it came to that because of Antonescu, who we've talked about before, how much he thinks of Antonescu. But he's kind of irritated, it seems, a little unhappy with Hungary. They're not acting the way he would like. Too independent, I guess.
That last statement, Carolyn, where he says, this is one thing about which we must be quite clear. Anyone here who gets ideas above his station and beyond the confines of his farm must be sharply jumped on. Now, to me, that referenced what he had just said about the farming, you know, and the 10 and 12 million tons of grain from this area, and they could build spaghetti factories, and that way they could... This area doesn't have much industry, but he could, if they built those factories, this will enable us to give a little extra back to these western territories, which are rich in industry, but bad off as regards foodstuffs. That's it. So to give them back their food. Now, that comment about anybody here that gets ideas above and beyond his station and the confines of his farm must be sharply jumped on. I took that to mean he didn't want to see some greedy people over there try to make this one hell of a capitalist enterprise.
What greedy people are you talking about? You think he's talking about greedy Germans or greedy Ukrainians or native people there?
No, it's just the people, whoever that might be involved in the farming and the enterprise of building those factories, and see that, boy, this could be a money making scheme or whatever. And to me, that's what he was doing, was just saying, hey, he didn't want this thing to turn into some guys, in other words, acting Jewish.
Yeah. He wanted to share the food with the western parts of Germany where they don't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
Or they didn't have enough agricultural land or anything. So nobody was going to be able to say, well, this is my thing and my business and I'm going to run it my way. No, it was going to be kind of run by the Reich and for the good of the whole Reich. And everybody was, according to the National Socialist philosophy, as a collective, that everybody would benefit, and nobody would be able to say, well, this my part belongs to me and I'll do what I want with it.
Right. That's a good point. That's it. And okay, ready to move?
Yes, let's move on.
The 9th of August, 1942, evening. Special guest, Gauleiters Berkel, Robert Wagner, and Simon. Riches in the Ukraine, the giant Stalin. There are here 1 million tons of wheat in reserve from last year's harvest. Just think what it will be like when we get things properly organized and the oil wells are in our possession. This Ukraine produces 13 or 14 million tons a year, even if we show ourselves to be half as successful organizers as the Russians. There's a cool 6 million for us. Next year, after the harvest, we must organize thoroughly and work at full speed. One thing which we have so far not taken into account is the fact that every 3 days there's a thunderstorm. This country is a regular forcing house. 50 degrees of heat one moment, then a torrent of rain, and then the heat again. Had
let
it
me
not
just
been
mention
for the
here,
mud.
Let me just mention here real quick, Ray, that I looked up forcing house. I didn't know what he was talking about.
Good.
And it is an agricultural term, a place where growth or maturity, such as fruit or animals, etc., is artificially hastened. So it's kind of like a greenhouse, what I would think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A greenhouse type thing, and he's saying that the whole country functions like that because it gets all this heat, then it gets all this rain, so it's all this humidity, and it just makes things grow.
Right.
And he's so impressed with the food production because he sees that has been for so long Germany lacks, and he's just thrilled to death to envision all this grain and whatever else, you know, they get out of there.
And, you know, when he says 50 degrees of heat one moment, you have to think in terms of centigrade, certainly not Fahrenheit.
Right.
And
right.
50 degrees centigrade is 122 Fahrenheit.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, he's talking about some very hot area there. Kind of remind me of my home.
Some places it probably is similar. You know, they do have all that sea. What is that, the Black Sea? The Black Sea there to create that kind of humidity.
Right. And he continues on, had it not been for the mud and rain last October, we should have been in Moscow in no time. We have now learnt that the moment the rain comes, we must stop everything. When the war ends, the German people need not bother its head about what it's going to do during the next 50 years. We shall become the most self-supporting state in every respect, including cotton, in the world. The only thing we shall not have will be a coffee plantation, but we'll find a coffee-growing colony somewhere or other. Timber we shall have in abundance, iron in limitless quality. the greatest manganese ore mines in the world. Oil, we shall swim in it. And to handle it all, the whole strength of the entire German manpower. By God, how right the peasant is to put his trust solely in the earth. What's the use of talking about scenic beauty when the earth is oozing with wealth? In the future, it will be a pleasure to work. Stalin is half beast, half giant. To the social side of life, he is utterly indifferent. The people can rot for all he cares. If we had given him another 10 years, Europe would have been swept away as it was at the time of the Huns. Without the German Wehrmacht, it would have been all up with Europe even now. The doors of the continent would have been flung open for him by the idiocy of the masses. The worst of our winters is now behind us. In 100 years' time, there will be millions of German peasants living here.
Well, once again, there's a lot to say about that. And when he says the idiocy of the masses, shows that
yes.
He's not always, he doesn't worship the masses, nor does he actually think the masses know anything. He talks about the German folk, and he speaks about that in a very different way. But he still knows that, of course, if you say the doors of the continent would have been flung open, he's including all of Europe in that, and the idiocy of those masses, you know, who would just welcome, you know, which they have always done, welcome Marxism, communism, Bolshevism.
Sure. What he learned from his young years, and particularly after the war and World War One, the communist activity, and how much communism appealed to mm-hmm. so many of the masses, and
well,
I think
true.
That's what he's referring to right there.
Well, you're right, and I should have brought that. That's even more important. That you know that this the communist theories are very appealing to the masses who are don't know
they
any
have
better.
Not.
It just promises them things. Yeah,
that's right.
But it's going to be a harsh awakening when they get it. Mm-hmm. Now the other thing he says. Did you want to say more while I'm trying to find where I was?
Well, I just want to say here also where he said this could be taken wrong. He talks about the peasant, how right the peasant is to put his trust solely in the earth. And then he says, what's the use of talking about scenic beauty when the earth mm-hmm. is oozing with wealth?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that statement right there can be taken straight from something like John D. Rockefeller or capitalist exploitation. But what he's saying there is, yes, you can look upon this beautiful earth and this area right here. It's scenically beautiful, but it has riches for us, too, and we can take advantage of them. And he's not talking about destroying the scenic beauty. He's saying this part of the earth has other than aesthetic goodness and beauty to us.
Well, I took it a little differently because it reminded me of what my father used to say so much, which I got, you know, how you are with your father.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not that again, you know. But my father loved to travel to out west and to the mountains and scenic areas like that and look at them. But then he'd always say, oh, yeah, but back, you know, we lived in, as I said last week, in central Illinois. And, but that's God's country in Illinois. That's because of the deep soil that you could grow so much. Of course, all they were growing was damn corn to feed the cattle and the hogs. But anyway, it seems to me they wasted that good soil. But you know, see, he was saying that what's really more valuable is agricultural land. And so I took what Hitler was saying in the same way, that he was used to Austria and the beautiful scenic areas and so on, also in Bavaria. And of course, he loved it. You know, he lived in Ober-Salzburg. He loved it up there. That was his preference. But he was saying that, you know, that you don't grow anything there. You can't get much
mm-hmm.
there. It's what's in the earth that is
mm-hmm.
that we need.
The value.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you have a little of both. That's just the way the earth is made. And then he says, in 100 years' time, there will be millions of German peasants living here. So obviously they are in. He was in his headquarters at Vinnytsia in Ukraine, the one in Ukraine. And yes, they were there most of this time that we're dealing with lately and talking about, that's why I was talking about Ukraine so much, and there's a lot of action going on there too. They got to know the people living around in that area. As I said before, the National Socialists living at headquarters would go out and take walks and meet some of the women working in the fields and so on and have conversations, and they thought they were very good stock, very good folk.
In that area, Venezia suffered heavily under the Jewish commissars after the revolution. There was murder there, right and left.
No wonder then they were as happy with the Germans, which they were. They were very friendly
that's
to
right.
the Germans. Yeah.
I had a book about it was titled "The Crimes in Venezia," and it was fascinating, you know, and it just made you realize why those people opened their arms to the Germans when they came there, because of what the Jewish commissars had done, killed so many of them. Tortured them and everything else. So it was ripe for a friendship with Germany.
Terrible what's done, the way people have suffered. Mm-hmm. Okay, the timeline for August 9th. I guess we had the 9th before, but I thought it was the 8th, so now we're here.
Yeah, we had midday.
With the 9th. Yeah, now we have the 9th evening. Anyway, what happened on this day was that numerous riots in favor of independence in India. And Mahatma Gandhi is arrested. So that's what the British were dealing with that also at this time.
Right. August 11th of August, 1942. Special guests, Reich Minister Speer, General Reinicke, and your
headline. And General Reinicke
headline.
Is a general der Infantry.
All
okay.
Right. Reichsmark and Ostmark. Peace with Britain, the finest colony in the world, fabulous inventions of a gang of epileptic Jews.
Yeah, that's the Ostmark, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ostmark. Okay.
Meaning east.
Yes.
To east, which is what they called Austria after it was included into the German Reich. It was called the German Ostmark. No, I mean not the Ostmark, but the Ostreich or something.
There you go, that's right.
Yeah.
The German Reichsmark must be made unassailable and must become the most stable currency in the world. Here, in the East, there exists in reality only one currency, the produce of the soil. For local usage, we will create an Ostmark. We will fix the rate of exchange at 5 Ostmarks to the Reichsmark. But tourists coming here will be given only 100 Ostmarks for their 100 Reichsmarks. For with that, he can get as much value here as he can with 100 Reichsmark in Germany. The difference will be pocketed by the state. Prices here and at home are quite different, and they must remain so in favor of the Reich. This will give us the wherewithal with which to pay for the war. Our goal must be to reduce the war debt from 10 to 20 milliard marks a year, and thus become the only belligerent of this war to be free of war debts within 10 years, and be in a position to concentrate, broadly speaking, on the colonization of the territories acquired. Any substantial war indemnity from our enemies, I think, will not be obtainable. From the British, we shall certainly get nothing. If the British were to come to me tomorrow and say that they would like to make peace on the basis that each bears his own costs, I should most probably agree. In actual fact, we've already been paid. The real profiteers of this war are ourselves, and out of it we shall come bursting with fat. We will give back nothing, and will take everything we can make use of. And if the others protest, I don't care a damn. We have the richest and best colonies in the world. In the first place, they are next door to us. In the second, they are inhabited by healthy peoples. And in the third, they produce in abundance everything we require except coffee. Within 10 years, the colonies of the other countries will have lost their value. The greatest boon we could get would be peace as soon as we can have it. The great ambition of the Parson clique is, and always has been, to undermine the power of the state. And for as long as we suffer these parsons in our midst, it serves us right. Every country gets the type of parson it deserves. At the moment, I can do nothing about it, and so I continue to keep them happy. But one of these days, I shall bring this conflict, as old as German history itself, to an abrupt and decisive conclusion. I'll make these damn parsons feel the power of the state in a way they would never have dreamed possible. For the moment, I'm just keeping my eye on them. If I ever have the slightest suspicion that they're getting dangerous, I'll shoot the lot of them. This filthy reptile raises its head whenever there is a sign of weakness in the state, and therefore it must be stamped on whenever it does so. We have no sort of use for a fairy story invented by the Jews. The fate of a few filthy, lousy Jews and epileptics is not worth bothering about. The foulest of the carrion are those who come clothed in the cloak of humility, and the foulest of the foul is Count Praising. What a beast! The Popish Inquisitor is a humane being in comparison. Vileness and hypocrisy walk arm in arm. Both must be extirpated. The uselessness of the parson is nowhere better illustrated than here at the front. Here we have enemies who are dying by the million. And without a single one of these liars, the Catholic Church has but one desire, and that is to see us destroyed. When Eckert was in Landsberg, the prison parson came and said to him, "Eckert, if anything should happen to you, which God forbid, have you given a serious thought to the future?" "I have given the question of the hereafter much more serious consideration than ever you have done, my good sir," replied Eckert. "And if the hereafter is in reality what you believe it to be, then take it from me. I can be of more help to you than you can be to me." Dripping hypocrisy with the swift and poisoned arrow behind it.
Well, boy, he really got into that, didn't he?
Before
we talk about that, I'll say what I wanted to say about the first part. What he says, if people protest, I don't care a damn. I kind of like that because he's saying, you know, we deserve what we've worked hard and we deserve what we're getting here. You know, we're not doing war profiteering, but we should come out of this well after all we've done. And these others who have stolen from us all these years and you know, taken everything.
Right.
Why should I care? And he's saying we don't care about them. And and then the fact that he considers, you know, he has been saying that for a long time that he didn't think that Germany should have colonies in Africa or Asia or like the other European countries did still. And he wanted Eastern Europe. And he yeah, and he says, you know, they're right next door to us. It's just so easy. You just go right over there. And then he says
they're
good healthy.
People.
Yeah, they're good people. And what I think, you know, it's also, I would add, and he's probably thinking, they're not black, they're not Negroes, they're white people.
That's exactly
and
right.
That's just so that's, much better, you know. And he's
yeah,
really,
that's
you know,
how I took it, too.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And then well, this last part, what did you about the church and the parsons?
This Count Praising, I looked him up. He was the Bishop of Berlin, I think, and he was very anti-national socialist.
Yeah. From 1935 until his death, he was Bishop of Berlin. I don't know when his death was, but let's see. His death was, 1950. So, wow, I've never heard of him. I've never heard him written about, remember him written about before, but he is considered as in a part of the Catholic, a significant figure in the Catholic resistance to Nazism.
Yes.
But I thought all the ones who were serving in Berlin at that time were sympathetic. I never heard of this. Well, I guess he was
but
the
Hitler
Bishop
had him.
Of Berlin. Okay. Berlin, the city of Berlin, there's other bishops of other places, like the bishop at Munich.
I think he was later made a cardinal.
Yeah, well, probably. That's what happens to those bishops.
Yeah. I think he was.
He was resisting, but probably acting like he wasn't, and probably, you know how that hypocrisy thing is. Hitler got so sick of it. So he was really fuming here about him.
Mm-hmm. And I'd I really thought it was funny when he made reference to Eckert in the Lynchburg prison, and the prison parson came to him and said, "Hey, you know, if you think about dying, if anything happens to you, have you given serious thought to the future, meaning after death, you know, meaning
yeah,
hereafter?"
Right.
And Eckert tells him, "Hey, you know, yes, I have, probably more than you. And in fact, if the hereafter is the way you conceive it to be, I can help you a whole lot more than you could help me." I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, it was good. But, you know, here he's when just a little before that, Hitler is saying that, really using really strong language, saying we don't have any use for a fairy story invented by the Jews. Now, here he is saying, like so many of these people that I've kind of resisted for so long, he himself is saying that it's an invention of the Jews. And he's saying that, then he's calling the, saying a few filthy, lousy Jews and epileptics are not worth bothering about. I guess he thinks some of these prophets or whatever in the Bible were epileptic. But I wonder when he used the word lousy, if it means, you know, covered with lice, you know, if it refers to lice.
I didn't think of that.
Because
that's
I don't
point.
Think, you know, lousy is a kind of a funny,
that's
you
an
know.
American GI term there. It's slang. So, lousy. Yeah, that's probably, you're probably correct.
Anyway, he's really fed up with what these religious people are doing. And at this time, it was probably getting a lot of these very sensitive things that they were doing at home, and these Catholic and Protestant people both were complaining about him. So let's go on if you're ready.
Okay, the 12th of August, 1942, midday. Marriage customs. German nationalists in 1921, Admiral Schroeder, the Marines.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've got it. I'm sorry, Ray.
Okay.
I've got, you know, there's a little tiny delay between your hearing what I'm saying. I realize that. I've got a timeline for quite a few days here. So I've got a timeline for the 10th. Rommel begins an attack around El Alamein. But by September, he is back to his original line. So there's no progress being made there, obviously, is what they're trying to say. And on the 11th, the HMS Eagle, a British carrier on convoy duty to Malta, is torpedoed and sinks with a heavy loss of life. You know, there was that whole convoy going there, and most of them didn't make it. On the 12th, at a conference in Moscow, now here's Churchill in Moscow. Churchill informs Stalin that there will not be a second front in 1942, which Stalin was obviously pushing for one. And right now, you know, in 42, it's August, and he's breaking the news to him that they're not going to be able to do one in 1942. And then in the Pacific, American forces established bases in the New Hebrides Islands. And back in Russia, fighting increases as the Germans approach Stalingrad. We have that coming up. Yeah. So now, I really like this section about Schroeder. Like it a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, agreed. And you know what? This first part I'm going to read here, he's talking about a wedding. That had crossed my mind many times years ago, Carolyn. Okay, quoting the Fuhrer, "I have never attended a wedding which was conducted with becoming solemnity. Marriage is a holy act, the binding into one of two human beings of different sex, less moving perhaps for a man than for a woman, but still a most solemn occasion. And what do most of the guests do but make pointed jokes at the expense of the bride and groom? I attended one wedding, that of Thiersch, at which every guest made a short and suggestive speech, and this was regarded as the height of wit. I wonder why it is. As regards superficiality, we are as children in comparison with the British. It is quite astonishing how trumpery trash and good taste exist cheek by jowl in Britain. I once had a book on British masterpieces of architecture, and what magnificent conceptions it contained. In London, the government buildings may be redolent with history, but history is made in the great castles of the countryside. The National Club in Berlin. I was taken there one day in 1921 by Ganser. The people had absolutely no idea whatever of how the German problem should be solved. One of the good gentlemen told me solemnly that all Germany's hopes rested on a car, that's K-A-H-R. The further away from Bavaria one went, the greater the stature of that car seemed to acquire in the people's eye. And in a non-entity like that, they placed their hopes of salvation. It was there that I met the old Admiral Schroeder, our first supporter. The next day, I went to the officers' club in the Pariser Platz. One of them, it was Schroeder who made the best impression on me. A grand old bull of a man charged with energy. My 1921-22 program had filled most citizens with consternation. They were even terrified lest people should know they had even heard of it. The purging of all foreign elements in Germany, introduction of compulsory military service, reconstitution of the German army, abolition of the freedom of the press, suppression of provincial governments. Good heavens, such ideas were pure blasphemy. People swore solemn oaths that they had never lent an ear to such things. But old Schroeder, the most energetic of men, that uncompromising fanatic, accepted the whole thing without further ado. He was to the Navy what Lützow was to the Army. Hoodier, too, was a national figure and a fine one at that, but he had, I think, a tiny streak of the Catholic in him. When I discover a man like Schroeder, I grab him at once. Schroeder had already retired when, during the war, he received the order to join up and raise corps of Marines. What we accomplished today is child's play in comparison with the efforts we were called upon to make then. Schroeder had absolutely nothing, but in no time he was leading his corps to battle. I myself saw these Marines in action for the first time at the Battle of the Somme, and compared with them, we felt we were the rawest of recruits. We then received orders to march to Austin for a test. The regiment arrived there in a most deplorable state. Any Russian regiment after a 500-mile retreat would have looked like the Brigade of Guards in comparison. While in Austin, I had the chance of going for a short trip on a submarine. And the sailors, smart, efficient, turned out always as if for a review. They were magnificent. It made one ashamed to be seen in their company. Turning to Admiral Konka, I suppose this accounts for the slight inferiority complex which the land forces feel in the presence of the Navy. We had to cut up our greatcoats in order to make puttees, and we looked like a bunch of tatterdemalion ballet dancers. They, on the other hand, looked frightfully smart in their belts and gaiters, and we were not sorry when we escaped to the decent obscurity of our trenches once more.
Well, that's interesting. It'd be nice to know even more detail about that. But anyway, a puttee is a gaiter or legging of leather or other material as worn by soldiers, riders, etc. And another definition is a long strip of cloth wound spirally around the leg from ankle to knee. So they had to, I thought it was strange that they cut up their greatcoats to make these gaiters for themselves. You'd think their greatcoat would be pretty important. I just don't know what to think about that.
Well, they wanted to at least appear somewhat, you know, because the Navy boys were dressed so impressively. And, you're talking about, that, and that's what it was. See, they thought, well, we're going on looking like a bunch of Russians who just retreated 500 miles, and here are these fellas dressed to the nines in the Navy with, you know, and so they cut those up and made those out of their coats, those leg wraps. And if you've seen pictures of American doughboys, you know, in World War One, a lot of times you'll see them with those wrappings around the legs. I never knew what they were until I read this, and you know, what they were for and everything, but they gave support, and they went from ankle to knee, and they did kind of dress up the soldier boy. And they were just common cloth, but apparently making them out of those coats, long coats that they had, it was supposed to look pretty impressive, and I think that's what he was about there. They were
He didn't think they looked very impressive, but
they were trying
that's
to help
they
the
did.
Situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the marriage thing, yeah, I get that. And this going to, I thought it was just really interesting what he had to say about his very beginning and going around managing to get invites or whatever to get into these clubs and political groups and so on, and I guess talk a little bit, and the people were amazed and horrified at what he was saying. They didn't even want anybody to know that they had heard it even. I thought that was funny, and I can believe it too. And he said
sure.
that his 1921-22 program was the purging of all foreign elements in Germany. That would shock everybody for sure. Introduction of compulsory military service, reconstitution of the German army, abolition of the freedom of the press, suppression of the provisional governments. Wow, that he came out real strong. He wasn't playing around.
Well, sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that when he said the purging of all foreign elements in Germany, primarily he meant the six-pointed star boys.
Well, yeah, sure, but he also meant that, you know, Germany should have Germans in it, because there were probably a lot of foreigners
well, yeah.
in Germany then.
Oh,
in
there
Germany,
were. There were occupation groups that had stayed there. But
yeah, right after the war, and Germany was reduced to such a bad situation because of the Treaty of Versailles. So everybody was going into Germany and doing whatever they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this Schroeder, I looked him up, and he was a general major. No, there was an infantry brigade under General Major von Weichmann that grew into the 1st Marine Division, and then an additional Marine Division was formed in 1914, November. And these two divisions were the Marine Corps Flandern, which is otherwise Naval Corps Flanders, under Admiral Ludwig von Schroeder, known in Germany as the Lion of Flanders, which didn't he say that? Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in early 1917, a 3rd Marine Division was organized, thus giving this infantry corps a strength of 60,000 to 70,000 men. And that's what Schroeder was leading. So it's pretty good that Hitler got this Schroeder on his side. But I guess was a real go-getter, you know, and he liked what Hitler was saying. He was a real patriot. Unlike so many of them.
He knew what the country needed.
Right.
You made a good point, you know, about the people. And I can imagine any people who were at Hitler's early meetings and listening to his talk and everything, and he was advancing these ideas that you just went over there. And I'm sure that there were many, many there that cheered and yelled and clapped for him that 10 minutes after they left there, if another crowd of people was talking about politics or whatever, and they mentioned, have you heard what that radical or fool Adolf Hitler is saying? I'm sure those same people said, I wouldn't listen to such stuff, you know. And you know, that's what he says. There's people support solemn oaths.
I don't know if they were cheering, because he doesn't say that. But
I think that there were some who certainly did.
Well, some of them, I think it's been pretty shocking for most people. But Schroeder took him there, and so took him places, so he thought they could listen to it. Yeah. Well, we don't know. I wish we knew more about all these times.
Right.
And we do. Okay. Now some isolated remarks, huh?
Yeah, 12th of August, 1942, isolated remarks. Fats, dancing and the artistic sense, Bavarian national costume. With this wartime soap, I can wash my hands as often as I like without fear of cracked skin. I do wash my hands very frequently on account of the dog, but with the old peacetime soap, I became very sore. Why is that? The experiment of extracting fats from coal has not been a success. It was the Reichsmarshal who pressed for it. I myself was against it. It seems rather absurd to use vegetable oil for soap making and eat fats extracted from coal. In the future, small arms must consist of machine guns and automatic rifles only. And every weapon must have a telescopic sight if accuracy is to be deadly. Dancing was the first method of artistic expression employed by man. The most beautiful dance in the world is without doubt the waltz, a perfect harmony of movement and music. After it, I should place the Schuhplattler dance of Upper Bavaria, which, thanks to its austere and dignified style, never makes a man look ridiculous. But the ballroom dancing of today? It's nothing but a series of simian posturings. In a film, one sometimes sees people dancing without music. It's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. Let me make a rather curious remark. The two professions in which one most readily reaches ripe old age are those of the actor and the officer. It's not really surprising, for these are the two professions in which one remains in perpetual contact with youth. It is not correct to say that life in the mountains is good for everybody. I'm thinking of Frau Endres and of my own sister Ellie, who came to us from Austria. If Ellie spends 6 weeks on end in Obersalzberg, she's got to go to Nauheim for a cure. There are some people who will climb up to the summit of the Gaul in boots, and if it happens to be raining, wrapped in a heavy coat. That seems to me to be an astonishing thing to do. Boots of themselves are unhealthy things, for they allow no ventilation. Moccasins are a very different proposition. The healthiest clothing, without any doubt, is leather shorts, shoes, and stockings. Having to change into long trousers was always a misery to me. Even with a temperature of 10 below zero, I used to go about in leather shorts. The feeling of freedom they give you is wonderful. Abandoning my shorts was one of the biggest sacrifices I had to make. I only did it for the sake of North Germany. Anything up to 5 degrees below zero, I don't even notice. Quite a number of the young people of today already wear shorts all the year round. It is just a question of habit. In the future, I shall have an SS Highland Brigade in leather shorts. We have made the uniforms of the Wehrmacht much more comfortable and practical. Engineers, for example, now work in bathing shorts. Attention to minor detail of this sort gives the men the feeling that they are being commanded by men of intelligence. If subordinates once get the idea that their superiors are lacking in intelligence, it's a very bad thing. Nowadays, the officers and men are united in one and the same entity. One still sees in Russia quite a number of handsome costumes. The owners must have kept them hidden. In my opinion, we should make a German Mediterranean of the Baltic Sea.
So these are a lot of assorted remarks. And I wanted
to mention, that's right.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that for those who are listening now and those who will listen and see the, you know, there's a presentation of photographs that move along during this program. And I put a lot of them on for this program, but there's something that went wrong and they're not showing up. And I asked about it and was told that they have a bug and there's some bug there or something and they're working on it. So if you're just looking at a blank black area there, that's sorry about that. I did have pictures, but they'll eventually show up, I guess. Now, this thing, you know, we're not going to get to that very last one that I thought we'd get to that I think is pretty important because we've got another one yet between now and then.
Yes,
and
that's
so
exactly right.
So I guess we'll start with that one next week because I don't, it looks like, because
right.
It's quite long. It's too long.
Yeah, it's 5 pages, and that's exactly where I had it marked here, Carolyn, that we would get tonight.
Just where we
are. Next one, and that's it.
Well, I went ahead with the other one thinking, well, we could probably get that. But look,
well, I did too. I read
but
it.
But I mean, it's. I thought we would, but I can see that we didn't. Anyway, this one is interesting. And
exactly.
We talked about this thing with fats before. And, of course, as we know, Germany has had trouble all the time with having enough fats. The people didn't have enough fat in their diet. They couldn't get hold of enough fats. And they were really hard to come by during the war, and they were rationed so much. So they were extracting fats from coal for eating. And he talked before about how he thought it'd be better to use the fats from vegetables for eating and the fats from coal for whatever else. But for some reason, a lot of them thought they wanted to use that fats from coal for eating. Can you imagine? I couldn't even imagine how you get fat from coal. But this just shows, too, the ingenuity of the Germans in finding ways to get things that they need.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he thought that whatever kind was easier on his hands than the other kind, probably the coal fat. But when he talks about dancing, you know, it's interesting that he's familiar, and I think he's right, don't you, about the most beautiful dance being the waltz, the most wonderful
thing to dance,
too.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that,
too.
Since I was a little boy, I enjoyed watching dancing and whatever, and to me, it hit my mind then, and it's still there today, that the waltz is the most elegant dance there is. And, you know, I love the waltz whenever I get the chance.
I do, too.
When he said, this is the most beautiful dance in the world, I agree. I mean, I felt that way for years. Yeah. I never knew he did, but, hey, well, I like it.
Yeah, and the Viennese are famous for the waltzing. Having these balls with all these women in gowns and men in tuxedos waltzing around the floor. Boy, what's so wonderful, you move so much. If you like to move through space, which you must like that, that's great. And then this Schulplattler is a hard thing to do, but he thinks that the men, even though they're in these shorts, he talks about how much he likes shorts anyway, they're in their leather shorts and their funny kind of socks that are a little thing around their calf instead of on their feet, and they do the steps, and boy, you have to be really limber and able to be in good shape to do those kind of dances.
Right.
But he likes that one. Now, the last part of this, when he says his sister's name is Ellie, well, his sister was Angela, and it was Angela who came from Austria to be his housekeeper at Ober Salzburg. And so I was wondering if that was a misprint, but that's what you have in your book, too, Elli.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it should
that's
be
correct.
Gelli, Jelly, because that was the shortened thing that they used for Angela.
That's it. That's a good observation. You're probably correct.
Well, I don't know if it's a mistake or somebody didn't understand or whatever, but that's who he's talking about, his sister.
Yeah.
And so now for the 13th, I've got a timeline. Our next reading is the 16th, but on the 13th, General Bernard Montgomery was appointed commander of the British 8th Army in Africa. So they... They weren't happy with the guy they had there, and they put him in charge. Churchill is anxious to see more offensive action on the part of the British. And I guess it worked out pretty well for them. Then there was a disastrous end to the Malta convoy, but one tanker and four merchant ships get through. And they considered that a big success because they did get some things through there. On the 15th, they got through, and Malta is supplied via Operation Pedestal, it was called. Here's what it says about it. Operation Pedestal was the attempt to run 50 ships past bombers, E-boats, minefields, and submarines, has gone down in military history as one of the most important British strategic victories of the Second World War. Well, naturally, they always play up everything the British do. But anyway, it says, however, it was at a cost of more than 400 lives, with only 5 of the original 14 merchant ships reaching the Grand Harbor. So the Germans put up a real barrier to them, but they did manage to get some supplies to Malta. Okay.
Okay, we'll go to the 16th of August, 1942, midday. The Tsar Ferdinand and some diplomats ways and means between Russia and Britain. I always hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Dragunov has copied the features and the gestures of Ferdinand to perfection. Anyone would mistake him for the old man if only he would eat a little more, put on a small tummy, and dress appropriately. He said to me, "I have no idea what to do when I get to Madrid, but I'll do my best for Germany." History is a most untrustworthy guide. The Bulgarians are now behaving as if the developments in the Balkans were all the results of their own decisive action. In reality, Boris, caught between his cupidity on the one side and his cowardice on the other, was so hesitant that the strongest intervention on our part was necessary to make him do anything at all. Old Ferdinand wrote some very straight letters, too, pointing out that the hour of Bulgaria's destiny had struck. These Balkan people are quite extraordinary, and they have an astonishing gift for languages. There were some curious characters among the diplomats accredited to Berlin. The Dutchman, who had a young and beautiful wife, was concerned chiefly with fussing and watching over his ewe lamb, and he was in a fever if any man spoke to her. The Romanian, on the other hand, was, to say the least of it, most open-minded in this respect. He seemed to adopt the attitude that one little peccadillo more or less doesn't make much odds. His lady slept 16 hours a day and retained an astonishingly youthful appearance. One day she introduced me to a middle-aged lady, her daughter. Then there was a royal highness, a princess from Iran. She was a real baggage. She was taking lessons in painting and had a new master every week. If ever there were a man who repelled me, it was the Belgian. He was a real hard-bitten scoundrel and a sly and cunning fox. Well, now we have him exactly where we want him. But at the time in 1940, we committed a silly mistake for which my own personal stupidity is responsible. We should, of course, have treated him as a prisoner of war. On the other hand, one must remember that his sister is the Crown Princess of Italy, the one charming and delightful woman in the whole Italian court, and one who, alas, has been grossly maltreated there from the psychological point of view. Stalin is an anarchist, educated in an ecclesiastical college. Our newspapers ought to ask whether he and Churchill sang psalms together in Moscow. I cannot help connecting in my mind Churchill's visit to Moscow with the affair of the last convoy. I think Churchill was expecting some important development and went to Moscow hoping to return with the prestige of a great feat accomplished. That they had some big project in view, I am convinced. Otherwise, why should they have sent the Mediterranean fleet to sea? If they had seized Crete, that would have been a grievous blow, for the possession of Crete is vital to the holding of the North African coast, as they themselves admit. Their project, whatever it was abandoned, I think, because of the slight damage sustained by the three aircraft carriers. For without adequate air cover, any big operation is not feasible. I'm not at all sure that it would not be a good idea to publish a report that they had intended to attack Crete. I have a hunch that that was the intention. If they were carrying troops, we could be sure of it, for they have no need of troops in Malta. If it's true that they lost a battleship, that explains their hesitation. In northern Norway, we did not have any idea of their real intentions. It was before the Norwegian campaign, at the time of the Altmark outrage, that dear old Chamberlain said that I had missed the bus. There are today a lot of very superstitious people in Britain who consider that the case of the Duke of Windsor was a bad omen, for the king personifies the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what you just read about them losing all those ships?
Yes, 40-something that's what they're
ships
talking
and five
about,
made
I guess.
It through.
Yeah,
and see, I think he's talking about Churchill went to Moscow. He said, I think he was expecting some important development, meaning a big success with that convoy, and it was embarrassing. And that's why they're making a big deal about five of them made it through. What an accomplishment.
Well, I couldn't figure out why he was saying what he was saying, because it didn't seem to fit exactly. Because he's acting right. Like where there was just slight damage to this or that when they were sunk, as far as I know.
They weren't sunk, but...
Oh, I see. Well, anyway...
It was the, the supply ships that took the beating.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's obviously what he's referring to. And he doesn't seem to know that Churchill went there to tell Stalin that there wouldn't be a second front this year. If that is actually the case, that's what the timeline was saying. I mean, or something was saying that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the story is now, that's why he went. Who knows? But he doesn't seem to. He's wondering, you know, what he's doing there. He's really, naturally would be, have a lot of interest in that. But I guess, you know, they're able to keep that very top secret, and German intelligence is not able to break into that and find out just what's being said. That would be pretty poor on the part of the British, if they were. Well, I didn't know who this Dragunov is. I've looked him up, and I can't find anything, so I don't know what they're talking about. Dragunov has copied the features and the gestures of Ferdinand to perfection. I don't know who that is.
I looked that up, too.
Uh-huh.
There were, like, three or four listed that could not have been him. And then there was this character that to me would have been too early, so I was inconclusive on what I found on him, too.
Well, we're out of time, Ray, so should we just say good night and thank everybody, and please come back next week. We've got some very good material to start with. This has been Table Talk.
You bet. Yes, thank you for being with us.